Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 92 of Registry Matters. Larry, 92, we are like, soon we're going to surpass your age. I mean, that's just kind of a given. It'll just take a little while. But we are 8 away from 100.
That is true. And I think, it'll be 104, and that'll be a 2 years worth. But of course, we've skipped a few episodes, so we're probably coming on 2 years sooner than we realize.
We are just slightly over a month away from 2 years. We start, if I remember the date right, it's October 22nd is 2 years.
Is that right?
Yes. I'll have to go double check. We'll do some sort of birthday party whistle or something. I mean, obviously it won't line up on the exact day, but very close to that. I'm excited, man. That's 100. That's I mean, most podcasts I hear don't even make it to episode 7. If you make it past 7, then you've done something. But here we are coming up on 100. I'm excited.
Well, not only are we coming up on 100, but we had a lot of new patrons join us this week.
We did. Let's hit that real quick. I'll do the first half. You do the second half. We had 6 new people. We had Ryan, Brenda, and Sandy.
And I don't know who the others are.
Oh, well, okay. Then I'll just finish it up. It's Jonathan, David, and Carl. And again, I can't thank you guys enough. It is really amazing that people reach out and support us the way they do. And you get some perks. You'll get some Patreon extras. You get to download the show as soon as it's released. So usually I edit the podcast on Sunday, but sometimes I edit it on Saturday night. And you know, then there's also the Discord chat that you can get in on. There's a bunch of extras for you to sign up and be a patron.
So, well, hopefully we can do another 6 this week. And now I finally got my screen open. So now I can see the names that I didn't know.
Do you want to announce them just so you don't feel left out?
No, that's fine. Thank you, everyone, for supporting the podcast.
Let's dive right into the breaking news. This one is kind of an interesting thing that came up. This is a Second Circuit ruling between El Hadi, forgive me if we're going to butcher that name, and then Cable on private address verification. What's going on here, Larry?
Well, this is in Suffolk County, New York, where the county legislature is, I think the county legislature is what I think they call it there. They passed an ordinance funding for private address verification checks for people in the registry. And one of the people that was subject to those checks challenged it, and he lost at the trial court, and he lost at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, the United States Circuit Court of Appeals. So this is constitutional, and we're going to take a deeper dive into it later. But at first glance, when I read this, I was thinking, well, gee, I can see how they got to the decision, because anybody's got a right to knock at anybody's door and ask who lives there.
Why this excites me so much, because you know, it comes up every now and then. People ask us what quote unquote what is FYP Studios, and you know, go through the explanation. If you do not know what FYP stands for, by the end of this episode, I can guarantee you will know what FYP stands for.
So the last avenue of appeal for this would be a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, but in all likelihood, this is the end of the line for this individual and for those who did not think that they should be subject to these private checks by what is this called, Families Megan's Law, or whatever the heck the group is named. We'll get into it more later. But Suffolk County decided that the infrequent reporting required by New York state law was causing the addresses listed at the registry to not be accurate, and they were trying to improve accuracy. So they contracted to have private checks done. And this is what we're going to get into later in the deeper dive.
Awesome. I'm really excited. You know, as soon as we started talking that we were going to cover this tonight, I was like, oh, this is going to be like our signature episode. This will lay it all out on the line for us. But first, Larry, let's cover, we don't have many articles because we have all this extra super great content with these different decisions. So let's hit some of these articles. And we keep, I mean, it's almost every episode that we refer back to Larry Krasner out of Philadelphia. And here's another article. It says, Philadelphia district attorney exonerates 9 people in 19 months. He has his own little, like a case review group that are going back and looking through various cases. I think they said they only take 4%. I think that's at the very end of the article. But in there, they have found all these people that are serving not just a few months in prison or jail. They're not serving short little 1 and 2 years. There's this one, 74 years in prison combined across 4 or 5 people. That is a lot of human capital just wasting away in prison. And what I really want to get Ashley on to talk about this, not, I don't want to like put her on the map for, you know, call her out for being, hey, you're one of those prosecutors, but I want to understand the mindset of why would they withhold evidence to keep the person from being found not guilty? It's so annoying to me that our criminal justice system prosecutes people this way.
Well, in their mind, and I can't speak for a particular prosecutor, but you've heard the term, the ends justifies the means. They feel like that you're a bad guy. And when they look at a person's rap sheet, they say, well, maybe our evidence is tenuous on this, but we're going to get the person because he's been a thorn for all of these years. And that's one way they end up prosecuting a person where the evidence is not all that strong. Withholding evidence that would exonerate a person, I don't know how they can in good conscience do that, but I'd say it's the same way you can do anything else that's not ethical. It's the same reason you can pick up someone's wallet that they drop and you can pocket the money rather than trying to return it. It's personal ethics, the morality of any individual, whatever their moral compass leads them to do, that's the only answer actually anybody can give you, is that even though the ethics of the profession are that the prosecutor is held to a higher ethical conduct standard, it's still pretty much self-policing. All they have to do is say that, in my mind, we had a really strong case, and that was an oversight on the evidence. Oh, we wouldn't have withheld it intentionally, but the police report didn't get turned over to us in time, and we didn't turn it over to the defense because we didn't have it at the time, and it wasn't material to the facts. The person, they were still overwhelming. I mean, they come up with every excuse in the book to preserve their conviction.
I'm not attacking you for your answer, and I completely accept your answer. But these are people that we've elected. These are people that are, as you just said, they're in these incredibly powerful positions, and many times the people that they are prosecuting have zero resources. You know, I mean, they're living on minimum wage or just slightly over, and they have zero resources. They have zero expertise, nothing to help them defend against this massive, you know, juggernaut that's coming at them. And it's, I mean, unfair isn't a strong enough word.
Well, you should do a commission, a study of elected prosecutors, and see if you can get them to talk on background and ask them the ratio of calls that they get where people are infuriated, the citizens that elect them are infuriated that they're using extreme tactics to convict people versus the people that they're happy that they're putting bad guys off the street. And the answer to how they do that is because that's what the citizens want done. If they were hearing from the citizens, we rebuke you for using unfair tactics, and we rebuke you by the polls by not reelecting you as our district attorney, that would be a different. But they don't hear that. They hear accolades for putting bad guys away.
I understand. But it still just feels that they are supposed to be above that. I know that they're elected, therefore they're political, therefore they are answerable to their constituents. Moving them into something like a judge position where they're appointed and they're outside of that so that they can act with honor and integrity. And look at how much shit that Krasner is getting by the legislature trying to tie his hands from doing what his people elected him to do.
Well, that is a good point there, that when you actually have a citizenry say, we don't want you to be as zealous, we do want more diversion programs, we do want lower crimes given, less serious crimes given a lower priority. When you have the citizens expressing that, then you have the people who profess to believe in local control and local decision-making is best, the conservative assembly in Pennsylvania deciding that they will usurp the power of the elected prosecutor who's theoretically closest to the people by creating a new prosecutorial power at the Capitol, giving the attorney general the power to prosecute the things that the local district attorney has decided not to. Isn't that a great example of believing local governance is best?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And I know we're being facetious. I know it's not. This really, really, really bothers me a lot that this guy is doing what one article we covered maybe a month, 2 months ago. There were like 20 law professors that were supporting Krasner and his efforts, with all the efforts around all this criminal justice reform, diversion tactics, all that stuff, and the political body there, the legislature in Pennsylvania, is pushing back. Happens to all be Team Red. I'm not sure if that's a standard position, but that, you know, he's a Democrat and they're Team Red and they're fighting him.
Yeah, I hate to use that because I think it's more of a conservative ideology. It's just that the parties have become so polarized. You don't have liberal Republicans anymore like you used to have, and you don't have conservative Democrats anymore like you used to have. But it's more it's more philosophical. You know, when you get into the Team Red, Team Blue, I really hate that, because it's a conservative ideology here that the they want to give the law enforcement more and more power, and they want more and more people prosecuted. And I'm sorry, folks, that's the reality of the situation. Not 100%, because they're going to come back and say, well, Larry, don't you understand that it's your Team Blue that's attacking the statute of limitations in New York? Yes, I understand that. And I've condemned that. I've said that we're wrong on my team is wrong on issues as well. But you generally, if you look at the criticism when someone is trying to do justice reform, if it's not bipartisan, if you can't get bipartisanship, it is the conservatives who criticize the liberals. If someone can show me where a liberal is running against a conservative saying this person's too lenient on crime, we will gladly put that on the podcast, because that's not the way it usually goes. It's Obama's turning loose a tidal wave of crime on the United States by the fact that they were lessening the penalties for crack cocaine, and the disparity, and the fact that Eric Holder was instructing prosecutors not to seek enhancements, not to to stack charges. That was turning loose the bad guys. You have not heard that since the First Step Act passed. You have not heard any criticism of President Trump by Democrats saying that President Trump is turning loose a tidal wave of crime on the country. So I'm just saying,
and just to the contrary, you know, the first AG Jeff Sessions was like, "Hey, we're reversing that whole policy. We need to throw as much of as many books as we can at these people to make sure that they serve as much as time as we can possibly muster."
And not only did the Barr hasn't really deviated, the current Attorney General Barr has not deviated from that.
Right. No, definitely not.
They're still seeking enhancements and maximum penalties, and they've slowed down the process of reintegrating people on the backside of their sentences. You know, they were pretty standard people would get 6 months in the halfway houses in the federal system. They've cut funding. People are getting 2 and 3 months at halfway house, and sometimes nothing at all. And they're having a much more difficult time transitioning. But like I said, I hate to do it as a Team Red, Team Blue. I think it's more appropriate to say it's the conservative ideology.
Agreed.
That's what's at play here.
Yes. And okay, so enough of that soapbox. Moving on to an article from PIX11, PIX11. And this is New York's very own, is what their little subtitle is. And this is where two guys, I guess they were, they found a man named Jace Decker, who was 63, found sitting on a bench in Garrison Park. And these two guys just decided to beat the shit out of him until he died. I guess he died a few weeks later. But they did it with, like, they said, hey, you look like someone that's on the registry. That was their justification, it seems, to go and beat the shit out of this guy. And died a week or two later. We seem to be covering these more often, Larry, in the 92 episodes that we've had.
What's the problem with it? I don't know if it's an increasing trend or if we're hearing more about it, but I think that this one was particularly interesting because the homeless people were, when I listened to the story, I don't know if you're going to play it or not, but when I listened to it, they seemed to have been okay with it if the guy had actually been a sex offender. They seemed to be saying, the way I interpret it is, well, he didn't deserve this because he wasn't the guy. And by inference, if he had been the guy, he would have deserved this. And that's really troubling to me. If you're in the lower fringes of society where things have not worked for you for whatever reason, whether you were the major contributor or whether bad breaks caused you to be, the fact that you would be willing to relegate someone to being beat up if they happen to have made a mistake, I'm fairly certain that you made some mistakes in your life that helped contribute to you being in this position. So I found that a little troubling that well, it would have been okay if it actually been the right guy.
That is definitely a disturbing angle that people are taking on it for sure. So, like I said, I can play the clip if you want to hear the news clip.
Sure, it's not that long.
Those who knew him say Jace Decker was often found here on this bench at Modesto's Garrison Park.
He minded his own business for the most part. He just was going through his own life struggles and different adversities.
Without a home, acquaintances say Decker was a husband with a broken heart.
Pretty decent life and everything, and now I think he was more so just hurt over losing his wife. He just never really bounced back from that.
The Modesto Police Department reports Decker was attacked in this park on August 10th. The 63-year-old died just days ago.
I was sad. Nobody deserves to go, especially like that. Like, that is kind of inhumane. It's for no reason, honestly.
Investigators say these men, Matthew Arguello and Ruben Rosales, confronted Decker that night, believing that he was a registered sex offender. Detectives say Decker was not.
He never, caused no drama, no harm to anybody.
Investigators say during the attack, Decker pleaded with the suspects to stop and said they beat him until he was unconscious. The attack was unprovoked and gang-motivated.
It was just really sad because, like I said, he doesn't bother anybody.
Arguello is now in custody, but investigators say Rosales is a dangerous man and is on the run. The community here says Decker deserves justice.
Knowing the facts before you just step into the situation and try to handle, you're not God or you're not them, law enforcement.
I cannot figure out the motivation behind beating the shit out of someone just because, how would you see some dude sitting on a park bench and go, I was looking through the 40,000 people on the registry and he looked like somebody I saw, so therefore let's go beat him to a bloody pulp?
Well, I can answer that with a question. Why do people who serve prison time, why do they administer justice? And they complain the loudest about how, they don't treat us fairly. They treat us without any individualization. Oh, the system is so unfair. Oh, and then you let someone come in to a county jail who's merely accused of a crime, and they don't treat us fair, and we don't get due process. And then you let a person, their accusations be known of what they're in, what the police brought them in for, and you watch what happens to them. So if you can tell me why prisoners have their own hierarchy and why they have the justifications that they do to administer brutal beatings and the things they do, I think that would answer the question.
That sounds legit too.
I've never understood that about prisoners. Of all people, having known how bad the system is and how you can be erroneously charged unless you think it's only you who got a bad bum rap. Of all people, you should be the ones who would keep your paws off people and give them the benefit of the doubt, because that's what you claim you want, right?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, it's so funny and humorous because they really don't want that. And prisons, they're horrible about their own vigilante justice. People get beat up all the time for merely having this accusation made, much less those who are serving time who've been convicted by their plea. And of course, they say they coerced me to do a plea. Man, they stacked up 14 charges on me, and I didn't do nothing, bro. But they had so much on me, I had to plead to something. But they don't turn around and extend that same courtesy to others to believe that maybe they had charges stacked up on them and they had to plead guilty to something. I find that quite amusing.
Yeah, probably amusing is not the right word, right? I'm sure you're thinking of a different word. Let's move on to an article from the Associated Press where it's U.S. judge Tara Watchless violates constitutional rights. I think this is the El Hadi Watchless decision, correct?
Did it do that? It is.
All right. As far as I understand it, and I'm going to incredibly over-exaggerate, don't send me any hate mail. If you're brown and you worship a different kind of religion in the United States, these are the basis for you to end up on the terror watch list. And I know that's exaggerating and stereotyping and all that, but that is how this feels to be directed.
It very well could be. From looking at this case, this was a case out of Virginia, the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia. dealing with the terrorist screening database, the TSDB. Is this our deep dive, or are we just teasing it now? I think this is our deep dive.
Oh, right? No, we can totally cover it. Yeah, we're here for this.
Okay, so this is our deep dive. This case generated a fair amount of chatter on the NARSL affiliate list, and people sent me a couple of private emails about it saying, well, if a database for terrorists is unconstitutional, how is it that you can have a database for sex offenders and it's not unconstitutional? Of course, I don't know how they would have actually said it in that tone in an email, but I'm giving it a little special emphasis. And as I read the case, I started out being pessimistic. As I read the case, I started liking it more and more, because there's so much in this opinion. A lot of work was done on this case, a lot of work. And you can tell how much work was done when you look at the opinion. There's a document number, which won't be on the copy we're going to make available in the show notes, but in the actual, the way they docket stuff in the federal court system, when you open a cause of action, it's document number one. And then each document, as you go through a case, they just go in a numerical sequence. Well, this decision was document number 323. So a fair amount of activity has gone on in this case.
Oh, wow. Okay. I understand.
Over the years. And the case was filed. The case was filed back in 2016, I believe. So okay. this is an example of how litigation drags on and on and on, particularly when you're fighting the government. But this TSDB list that people find themselves on, it's different from the sex offender list in one regard, is that to be on the sex offender list, you have to have gone through a judicial process to get on the list. Now, I'm not going to vouch for how good that process is and pretend that it's not without flaws, but there is a process. You either are found guilty by a trial, by a judge or a jury, or you enter a plea of guilty, or a nolo, or an offered plea, or you're found not guilty by insanity in some instances, and that will still put you on the registry, but there has been a process. Well, as of June of 2017, there are 1.2 million individuals on this TSDB, and 4,600 of them are American citizens or residents of the United States. Now, if you look at the global number, you will quickly figure out that there are a lot more people that are being denied entry into the United States than would be where they would be Americans. 4,600 is a relatively small percentage of 1.2 million. Being a mathematical genius, you could probably do that for us real quickly. But it's a pretty small percentage.
Of course, first rule of podcasting: don't do math while trying to think.
But of the 4,600, if it happens to be you, then of course one is all that matters. But to get on this list, you do not have to have any process at all. You don't even get notice that you're on the list. So that makes this particular list very distinguishable from the sex offender registry list. Now, you can be on it by being, and I'm just reading from the highlights on the copy that I decided to use. So on page 3, you can be on the list by being a known terrorist, as defined as an individual who has been arrested, charged by information, or indicted or convicted of. Now notice it says indicted or convicted, charged. So you can be a known terrorist and not been convicted. So that'll get you on the, or you can be a suspected terrorist, as an individual who is reasonably suspected to be engaging in, has engaged in, or intends to engage in conduct constituting in preparation for an aid or related to terrorism and or terrorist activities. So you can be a suspected terrorist and you can find yourself on this list. And that is what makes the list completely different. very few people can claim that they don't know that they're on the sex offender list, because there's a process by which you go present yourself after some sort of adjudication process. Generally, you're notified that you're going to have this obligation, and the list is known to you. This list isn't known to you. You begin to find out about this particular list when you're detained at the airport or at a border crossing. Then you and you may not still know. You may go through an interrogation that lasts for hours, and you may eventually be allowed to proceed, or you may not be allowed to proceed, but you don't know what caused it. They don't tell you, well, you're on a terrorist watch list. So that is a big difference and it says an individual's placement in the TSDB does not require any evidence that the person engaged in criminal activity committed a crime or will commit a crime in the future, and individuals who have been acquitted of terrorism-related crime may still be on the list. Now, this is something that was determined in this case, that you can be on the list and have even been acquitted of the charges, because they can still view you as a terrorist threat, because just because you're acquitted doesn't mean you're innocent. It just means you weren't convicted. So I
read an article in Reason magazine, and this would have been somewhere around 2010, and they profiled a family that let's say they lived in Minnesota, somewhere up there near the Canadian border. They traveled over into Toronto to go to a wedding. And when they were returning, they had all kinds of problems. And again, these were brown people. These were Muslims. And these were American citizens. These were not immigrants. You know, these were not first generation naturalized citizens, as far as I recall in the article. And they weren't just you know, patted down and questioned for not a speedy, just kind of like waving through. They were like held for 8 hours without food, without water. Their electronic devices were taken and they were cloned. They were copied. They had all kinds of stuff violated. And as far as I understand it, the border control people do not have to follow the same sort of due process kind of things for having someone come into the country, even if they're a citizen. If I have that right, I may have like the specific nuances a little off color, but that started to deeply puzzle me as far as like, where does due process kick in? What are your rights coming into if you're a citizen? I mean, I would expect if someone's not a citizen that they would have a significantly reduced expectation of privacy and so forth. But if you're a citizen, if you're a Social Security card person, you know, you're a citizen, I would think that you would be quote unquote trusted implicitly, unless, you know, you have actually committed a crime. But these were people, as far as I understood in the article, that had done nothing related to it other than their religion.
Well, don't you think that's enough?
Not when you're supposed to have the religious freedom that the First Amendment affords you, whether that be a religious freedom or non-religion freedom.
Well,
you shouldn't be persecuted in either case.
I have a very close acquaintance that tells me that everyone knows that Islam is a religion of violence, and everybody knows that. Now, I'm quoting this person. This is not me saying that, so don't soundbite me on this, but I have been told that it's a terrorist religion, and everybody knows that. So
I know that you can easily cite very violent passages in the Quran. You can also turn right around and, again, don't send all the hate mail. There are factual, there are statements in the Christian Bible that are very violent also. And this isn't a religious podcast, but there are evil statements in both books.
So, back to what you were phrasing up as a question. I'm not an expert in what powers that they have at the border. They do have additional powers, and depending on how long the detention is going to be, the level of probable cause and suspicion has to increase. Courts are very, very lenient in terms of brief detention. At a DWI roadblock, for example, the time it takes to open the car, pass the driver's window, and see if a big plume of alcohol comes out, and if the person's eyes are twitching, and if everything about the car looks like it's out of order, there's a cracked windshield, the license plate is dangling, and there's enough clues there that would justify a longer detention. But if everything appears to be in order, the courts are very tolerant for a brief disruption. Where this became problematic, while attempting to return to the United States by car after a brief trip to Canada, plaintiff El Hadi was surrounded by CBP, which is Customs and Border Patrol officers, handcuffed and then escorted to a room where he was held for more than 10 hours and repeatedly interrogated about his family members and other associates. Now, the courts are not nearly as tolerant about a 10-hour detention as they are about a brief encounter.
Yeah, 10-minute detention.
Well, 10 minutes is pushing it, but a very brief encounter.
Oh, you think that's even too long, too?
Well, it depends on the circumstances, but it depends on what evidence they have to justify 10 minutes. If they need to run your NCIC, if there was something in the original encounter that, if they can say, which an officer can always do, he resembled someone I thought was wanted, and that justifies a longer detention. But a brief and very moderately short detention, the courts are tolerant because you're not being singled out. But here's at a roadblock, they're not singling you out. Everybody that pulls into the roadblock. Here, El Hadi was surrounded not because they were surrounding everybody. They surrounded him because he was on this TSDB list. And that's why he got detained. And then as you go through the facts of the case, on at least two prior occasions, he was detained for approximately 7 to 8 hours when attempted to cross the border into the United States and handcuffed, stripped him of his belongings, kept him in a cell, and prohibited him from contacting his attorney. That is going to get a whole lot more scrutiny when you've got this type of fact pattern. And at this point, I don't even know if he knew why this was happening. I don't know that he knew he was on this list because unlike the sex offender registry, they don't tell you that they're considering putting you on the list. And they do that for security reasons. If we think you might be a terrorist, we're going to say, oh, Andy, we have gotten information that you might be linked to terrorism. And we're putting you on notice that we're investigating you. And in the meantime, we're going to put you on a watch list. That probably would not be the best way to go about ferreting out if that person has connections to terrorism. So the government can arguably make the case that they should not notify you. But at some point, I think you ought to be notified. And I don't know where that magic line is. But yeah. As a result of these three experiences, El Hadi stopped crossing the border altogether and stopped flying for more than a year. And this is where, on page 6, this is where my eyes began to perk up and my ears started perking up because I said, whoa, now, there's a direct correlation here because people who are on the sex offender registry, when they have to encounter the enhanced scrutiny that I'm told, I've never done any international travel, but the enhanced scrutiny of being interrogated simply because they're on the list, I'm seeing a parallel of some sort here because even though they receive due process, it's having a chilling effect on them. He stopped traveling because of this. Well, I've had offenders tell me the very same thing. Well, I don't fly anymore because I'm always going to go through this enhanced security, and I feel like it's because I'm on the registry, and so I started perking up about that page 6 in here because I see some parallels.
And what violation would that bring up that would give you pause that you know this could be something in our camp to use as part of our arsenal?
Well, in terms of travel, there are legitimate needs to travel, both domestically and internationally. Now, just because I've made the statement there are legitimate needs to travel, that doesn't mean that entitles you to enter the other country. But it entitles you to be unferreted on your exit of the way out of the United States as you leave here. And as I look at international Megan's Law, although there's nothing that says you can't travel. You can get on the plane in JFK, and you can fly to LaGuardia, you can fly to Melbourne, Australia, you can fly to Bangkok, Thailand, you can fly anywhere you want to. When they land and you go through their entry process, they may not admit you because of the reputational harm that's been done to you as a result of the list that you're on in the United States. So there's where I see the parallel. Well, it certainly would deter a person from traveling if they felt like that they were going to be stigmatized because of this list. The difference is to be on our list here, you have had some sort of process to end up on the list, where on this particular list here, this TSDB, you don't have any due process to end up on the list. But
is it? Do you think that this enters into some kind of First Amendment kind of claim?
I don't think. I don't think travel's in the First Amendment, but I think that it's enshrined that you have the right to travel, and certainly you have the absolute right to travel domestically. But you also have the right to travel internationally to the extent that the country wants to admit you. And that's where I keep dicing the apples so carefully. The U.S. doesn't say you can't go to Melbourne. Melbourne yeah. says we don't want you to come in. So you can fly to Melbourne all you want to.
Mm-hmm.
so they're not impeding your navigational trip to Melbourne. But what they're doing to you is impeding Melbourne admitting you when you get there because of the list you're on.
The reason why I bring up 1A is because you have the freedom of movement, you have the freedom of expression, association, and if that is being curtailed because of enhanced harassment, just by being on the registry, you're done with your sentence, you're done with all that stuff. That seems like that would then be a 1A claim.
It may well be. That's why I'm perking up on this, because this is such a good read when you go through it. The plaintiffs brought this now April 5th, 2016. Now we're way back, what, 16, 17, 18, 19, almost 3.5 years ago. And their counts are that it violated procedural due process, that it violated substantive due process. And I'm not smart enough to explain the difference. That was count one and two. That it violated the Administrative Practices Act, count three, the Equal Protection Clause, count four, and then all the non-delegation doctrine, which we just recently talked about the Supreme Court in the case of Gundy. So they had five claims in here. I didn't see one where that speech is asserted, but equal the due process. Arguably, you've had due process to be on the registry, but then again, arguably you have not when it comes to how the list is disseminated and how long you remain on it. Because if you've had a conviction against a minor, which is the criteria to be covered under the passport marking, if you've had that conviction, and as long as the state registers you, the current administrative practice is to mark those passports. Well, if you live in a state that requires everyone to register you for a lifetime, everyone to register for a lifetime, then you have a lifetime registration obligation, which, although you had due process back in 87 when you got convicted of the sex offense against a minor when you were 22 and the minor was 16, so you do in fact have a conviction against a minor, there's been no due process since 1987 to see if there is a compelling reason to have you on this list any longer. So I think there just might be something here in the way of due process that's lurking as I was reading through this.
I want to say that you have felt that to be true even before reading this, other than that this is another arrow in the quiver that you can use for citing things, right?
I have felt on the 21-day advance notice. Right. I believe that is a prior restraint, and I haven't really articulated this before, but it's clear in this decision. It has a chilling impact on you, which that is a First Amendment type. I mean, if you're chilled from doing something, it has a chilling impact. If you're going to have to provide a detailed itinerary if you're in international travel 21 days in advance, and you're fearful of prosecution if you get that itinerary wrong, that would have a chilling effect, which you may have legitimate economic interest. You may have an ownership interest in a business that does business offshore, and you may have a legitimate property interest in traveling, and this may chill you. So I see lurking beneath the surface here. If this is upheld on appeal, and usually everything like this is appealed, but if this is upheld on appeal, I see some good stuff in here. In terms of awesome. developing here. Now, what I like about this for the legal beagles out there is that summary judgment, we're going to talk about that in one of the other cases, summary judgment is something that I harp about, because we hear, well, Larry, you don't understand. The Supreme Court found that recidivism was frightening high. No, they actually did not find that. Well, Larry, it says right there, maybe you don't know how to read it. It says right there in the decision, I'll tell you what the page number and paragraph number, it says that recidivism is frightening high. Yes, it does say that in Smith versus Doe. It absolutely says that. But the Supreme Court did not find that. That fact was established below. And the Supreme Court is not a fact-finding tribunal. It is handed facts and it rules on the law. And summary judgment is too often the way these cases are decided, which is the way this case was decided. So if you page down, if you scroll down to page 7, I've highlighted the standards for summary judgment. And I think it would be good for people who don't understand summary judgment to understand when a party makes a motion for summary judgment, be it the plaintiff or the defendant, if that the party who did not move for summary judgment is entitled for everything that they pled in the way of a defense to be assumed true. So in this case, this was decided on summary judgment. So the court goes into great lengths to explain, and I don't want to read a whole lot of this here because we'd be here for longer than I want to be, but the summary judgment, all the facts that have been pled are assumed true. So the party that wants summary judgment says, hey, judge, there are no facts in dispute here. And the other party can say, well, judge, actually, there's not enough of a factual record here, and we object to summary judgment. We need a trial to determine this. But if there's no opposition and the non-moving party says, okay, judge, we're happy with this because we've asserted a bunch of things in our pleadings that we say that the rate of recidivism is frightening high, that is the basis by which the court makes the decision, because the parties agreed in summary judgment that all the facts that have been pled and any doubt is resolved in favor of the non-moving party. If there's any iota of doubt, anything they said that would have been their defense is assumed to be true because they didn't have a chance to have a trial.
And that would be the time for them to bring out whatever they want, whatever dirty laundry they want to air is that time.
Well, if when you file your complaint, if I'm representing the state of Alaska and I say, well, the reason why we did this is because recidivism is frightening and high. Well, if you turn around and move for summary judgment and you say, well, we don't care about what your defense is, we think that it's an ex post facto thing, you can't do it. Well, the court has to decide based on my defense I asserted. They have to make their decision saying, well, recidivism is frightening and high because everybody agreed there was no need for a trial, and that is a fact that the parties agreed to.
I do understand. It took me, I got to be honest with you, I shared this with you earlier today, that we've talked about this before, and I didn't understand this fully then, but I'm not going to say that I fully understand it now, but it has become significantly more clear about the summary judgment concept being just something that everybody, hey, all right, fine, we're not going to argue that, and we're going to let that go.
Well, once a motion for summary judgment is made and has been supported in the motion that there's no material facts, the opposing party has the burden of showing that there are genuine disputes. And I'm reading directly from the opinion on page 8. And it says, whether a fact is considered material is determined by the substantive law, and only disputes over facts that might affect the outcome of the suit under the governing law will properly preclude the entry of summary judgment. So you would argue, if you were the plaintiff, you would say, well, judge, they've said that recidivism is off the charts, and we'd like to put on evidence that it isn't, because that defense will completely fold if we put on evidence. And if you don't say that, then the judge says, okay, the parties have, it says on a motion for summary judgment, and I've got this highlighted, the facts shall be viewed and all reasonable inferences drawn in light most favorable to the non-moving party. You cannot be any clearer than that, that on summary judgment, the facts shall be viewed and all reasonable inferences drawn in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Huh. All right. Is there anything else before we move on?
Well, there's other good stuff in here about about having a justiciable controversy, about forward relief. And I've talked about the importance that you have to have, that you can't have hypothetical harm. So I highlighted in there about as a general proposition, in order for a plaintiff to have standing, they must have suffered an injury, which a concrete with which is a concrete and particularized and actual or imminent, not conjectural or hypothetical, and there must be a causal connection between the injury and the conduct complained of, and it must be likely as opposed to merely speculative, and the injury must be will be likely redressed by a favorable decision. And that was where the International Megan's Law broke down, because there was a lot of speculation about harm that would come, and we didn't know what they were going to do yet when they passed that law, and we didn't know how they were going to implement it. And so we were just merely speculating about what might happen, and that's not nearly enough to get forward relief. And this is in the decision here.
And when you say injury, you're not actually referring to like injury, like a violent crime injury, right?
No, it could be any type of injury, but you have to be able to show that without this relief, that imminent harm will happen. And for an injunction, the standard is actually irreparable harm. That even a harm could happen, but as long as it's not irreparable. And we weren't able to show that with International Megan's Law. We didn't know how they were going to implement it. And you mean
like what kind of mark on the passport, anything like that, right?
Correct. We didn't know. We knew that the statute said that the Department of State, the Secretary of State, had the authority to revoke passports. We knew that. We didn't know that he would do that. At the time, we didn't know the administration changed, but we didn't know that they would revoke passports. We knew that they had the authority to mark passports, and we knew that they were directed to come up with a specialized marking. We didn't know what the marking would be. So therefore, we didn't know what harm you might suffer, because we didn't know if it was going to be like in Alabama, where it'd be great, big orange letters across page one of your passport saying convicted sexual predator, or if it was going to be in little tiny letters in the endorsement page, which is kind of what it is. It's in very, very small in the endorsement page. We didn't know any of that at the time. So therefore, we were just operating in wild speculation about what might be done with the implementation. That's not enough to meet the standard of irreparable harm. And to merely argue that you can't mark a government documents are marked all the time. And we've talked about that on the podcast. Your underage driver's license is marked. In our state, they make them vertical. I don't know how they do it in your state, but some states, they put under 21. Our state, they do it vertical. If you have been convicted of a DWI and you have to have an ignition interlock, they'll give you an ignition interlock license. It's marked. There's nothing unconstitutional about marking documents in and of itself. So it depends on how they mark the document. We didn't know enough. And then there's the basic rationale of ripeness, which is addressed here. It says to prevent courts from through it says the basic rationale of ripeness doctrine is to prevent the courts through avoidance of premature adjudication from entangling themselves in abstract disagreements. A case is not ripe when problems such as inadequacy of the record or ambiguity will make the case unfit for adjudication. We didn't have enough of a record at the time, and therefore it was not ripe. Now, it's ripe now, and I do believe that within the 21-day advance notice, I believe that that is an area where there could be possibly some traction gains, and I've said that over and over again, because it chills your travel and it doesn't provide for travel that can't be planned. There are people who have businesses where you just can't plan travel 21 days in advance. And even if you could, you don't know where you're going to stay. You're going to do some shopping potential along the way, and you're going to do some negotiating depending on what country, and you do a lot of bartering and dickering and negotiating. You don't know where you're going to stay. You're going to stay where the opportunity makes best for you.
Yeah, I mean, you could be, you know, in my case, doing IT work. Someone could call you and say, hey, we need you on the ground in 24 hours, and you have to fly somewhere. And you can't say, all right, I'll be there. And now you lose that gig because of the 21-day advance notice stuff.
Absolutely. So I do think there's some ripeness now in International Megan's Law. And I think that there could be some traction, but that won't bring down the entire International Megan's Law. And what people, I think we had a listener ask about this, the International Megan's Law, it's not just a one-way street. They act as if only the United States is a part of it. That's the reason it's called International Megan's Law. There are a number of nations, and I can't give you the precise number, but there are a number of nations that are participating. The U.S. is also receiving notices, and I can't give you the ratio. The U.S. is a very large country. We have 330 million citizens. So, but we're receiving information from people who have their own citizens who have been convicted of these offenses, and the U.S. is getting advance notice of them coming here. And we don't like people coming here to engage in sexual exploitation of our children. And I'm wondering, it surprises me that of course other nations feel the same way about their children. The average parent in Thailand, I think, is one of the maybe not the capital, but it's one of the places where there's a lot of exploitation of minors. I doubt the average Thai parent is sitting there and saying, I'm hoping my teenage boy can come home tonight and tell me about how many Western travelers have been perving on him. I just don't think that's the average parents. I just don't think they like it either. So this is a two-way street where we're also trying to get information on people that we would not want to admit into the United States. And not only do we want information about people who have sexual deviancy, we want information about people who are on terrorist watch lists, those 4,600,000 people that we talked about that are on that. We get information and bulletins all the time about those people. And they are detained at airports and ports of entries, and they're put into interrogation rooms, and they're turned back. That happens all the time. So international Megan's Law is not just a one-way street. It is information actually flows to the United States as a result of that.
All right. That's a lot to cover on an article, on a decision that isn't even really directly related to us.
but it has the potential to be very related to us, because they go into the reputational harm and how this TSDB list is transmitted available to 18,000 law enforcement agencies and hundreds of other non-law enforcement entities, and how that information, the leakage effect of it, and how it can harm your reputation, and how that decisions can be made adverse to your life because you're on this list. I see that as a potential for us to utilize in our litigation. So I see a very close connection potentially for this case if it's upheld on appeal.
Amazing. Amazing.
And the right to travel is covered. There's cases cited here about international travel that I've never heard of before, from 1958. I have not read those, but there's, you legal guys and gals, read this because and do some homework. There's a lot of good. There was time spent on this. The judge's law clerk was very good.
Excellent, excellent, excellent.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Let's move over to an article from WBUR. And Larry, you know, we don't have to spend a lot of time, but this is one of those articles that we get to bash the American way of thinking about our criminal justice system. This is a Colorado woman gave birth alone in jail cell, says her cries for help were ignored. Now she is suing. I cannot believe you can find a video, and there's a lot that they cut out. They censor it, I guess you could say. This is unbelievable that this could happen. And she was in labor for, I think, 5 hours. Holy crap.
So what's the problem with that, Andy?
She was locked up, I believe, for some form of identity theft. So, you know, she's not quote unquote innocent, but I believe that she was pre-trial. So, you know, innocent until proven guilty. And she's there at the door screaming to the prison guards that she is like, hey, I'm feeling labor-y. And she proceeds to go through, and she's writhing on the bed, and she pops a baby out. Unbelievable that we could allow this to happen.
Well, it's hard to imagine. I was being flippant, but it's hard to imagine that could happen, because it says in a Denver jail cell. So we're not talking about a little podunk city. with a five-person jail. We're talking about a major urban area that has a huge jail operation, and which means they would have medical intake. That would be one of the questions they would generally ask you: are you pregnant? They probably don't ask men that, but I'm guessing that they ask female prisoners. Anybody that's listening in chat that's been booked, I would imagine that would be a routine question. That's a part of a medical intake. You need to know the condition of your inmates because of a potential liability. So it's hard for me to imagine that her record would not have been noted when she entered the jail, assuming unless she's been in jail for 9 months and got pregnant in jail. I mean, that is a possibility that could happen in jail. I have heard of pregnancies occurring while people are incarcerated, but I'm guessing she was admitted to jail being pregnant. So, in that being the case, it would seem like to me that she would have been charted by medical to be watched closer and closer as the delivery date approached. I mean, maybe I'm missing something here.
I am pretty sure she had not been in there for terribly long. I don't even think more than a handful of days, if any. How in the world does this happen? Due to her high-risk pregnancy. So she's already in there known to be in a challenged state of giving birth. Sanchez was placed in a medical observation cell with 24-hour surveillance in case she needed medical help. So, yeah, they knew what was going on, and they chose to... somehow they chose, either out of neglect, out of not paying attention to it. Maybe there was some sort of riot going on elsewhere that they couldn't pay attention to it. Maybe, I will give them some level of out, but this is unconscionable.
Well, I didn't read far enough down. I did an Andy read, but it says she was in a medical unit, which is what you just said. And so it says she was in a medical unit under the care of Denver Health medical professionals at the time she gave birth. The spokesman for the department told Here and Now in a statement to make sure nothing like this happens again, the Denver Sheriff's Department has changed its policies to ensure that pregnant inmates who are in any stage of labor are now transported immediately to the hospital. Well, what about that? You would think that would already be a policy.
Yes. Yeah. Because of this incident, they had to change their policy. So women should be this is at least reasonably related to the lady that we covered that was handcuffed. We covered that article.
So it says,
then they had to change their policy of handcuffing women to shackling them to the table as they're giving birth. Because in the off chance that someone goes postal and pulls some Jeffrey Dahmer and starts eating doctors as she's giving birth.
Well, that's usually driven by law changes. They don't have the ability to the human decency to do that by policy changes. So they'd say, well, all of our prisoners, when they're hospital, we have a policy that we restrain all of our inmates. That's policy number 8.7215B or whatever. And you say, but that policy is driven by common sense. Women don't generally run when they're giving birth.
They probably don't do much of anything other than kind of keel over in cramps. And I'm not laughing at you ladies. Please don't take this that. I can't imagine that you're much more than not functional to try and flee or do anything of harm to anybody as you're popping out a baby.
Good grief. But even without a policy, I mean, I can't believe that a large metro jail urban center would not have a policy already. But without a policy, it would seem like to me, you could think that through. When I was in property management, we didn't have written policies for everything that happened. When things happened that were out of the day-to-day grind of doing business, we had to make a decision based on all the information we had. And I think I may have told you a story off air, but I had one where there was a domestic violence and the police wanted me to open the door for the apartment so that they could arrest the man. And I refused to do so. And they said, well, if you don't open the door, finally a very kind and compassionate officer, he said, well, it's like this. He said, law requires us to make sure that the person who's saying I'm okay is not saying so against their will. He said, so therefore we have to enter that unit. He said, so therefore it means that we're going to enter it using our own techniques. Or we're going to enter it using your key. And we're going to give you a couple of minutes to figure out which way you want us to enter. So I didn't have a policy. I didn't have anything in my desk that told me how to deal with that. All I knew was that I didn't want to be a tool of the police opening doors because I wanted my tenants to know that I valued their privacy. On the other hand, I had an owner ownership group that didn't want me to be having to rebuild the side of a building because I was intransigent and because I let the police take a battering ram and knock the door of the building down, and then I was going to have a family that needed housing. So I had to look at all the totality of all the circumstances I had, and I had to make a quick decision. Well, even without a policy, there should be somebody on duty at the Denver jail that says, yeah, the record shows she's pregnant, so we don't think she's faking that. And as normally, babies in America, unless there's a midwife, they're typically delivered in a hospital. This is flagged as a high-risk pregnancy. So I think we better transport her. That seems like the thing to do. It doesn't seem like you would need a policy. It seems like common sense would walk you through that.
You're absolutely right. And there's a pretty heavy flurry of traffic going on in the chat right now about this. And I would point us back to that we, through our inaction, we allow this to happen. Same as with our law enforcement apparatus that we talk about so regularly. This shouldn't happen because when these policies, these laws, everything that was coming down the pike, someone could have stepped up and said, you're not going to do this to these people. We incarcerate too many people that they can't pay attention to them. This is we, the people, our fault for not policing our elected officials.
I second that 100%. There should be outrage, and there isn't. The outrage would change.
Because she's a criminal.
But there should be outrage.
She deserves this, right?
Yes. So
it's unbelievable. It's unconscionable. This is way up there. I don't want to like grade things. Is this worse than the guy getting killed with his bare hands? This is so far inhumane to me that you could allow this to happen. That I'm just kind of overwhelmed with rage. This is like the kid jumping off the building from being interrogated in Illinois. Let's move over to this article with the County of Suffolk and Parents for Megan's Law. This is the second court decision that is going to be so much fun. This is our signature episode, Larry. This is going to be the defining episode for FYP Studios.
Well,
can you give us a synopsis of what this is about?
I don't know if I would go that far. But this is the case that is a precedential case now because it's been decided by one of our United States Courts of Appeals. For the Second Circuit, and it's the case of John Jones versus the County of Suffolk and Parents for Megan's Law. The two defendants were the county and the parent, a private organization called Parents for Megan's Law. And this is a decision that I'm disappointed. I can understand how they got to this to where they got to, but it's certainly disappointing. So we're done.
This is okay. All right. I was going to try and dig in a little bit more as to my understanding. So this county hired, contracted with this nonprofit group to go and conduct home visits. So this is them, you know, hi, who lives here? We're trying to make sure that John Smith lives at address 123 Main Street. Can you confirm or deny that John Smith is actually living here? Is that sort of like what's going down?
Sort of like what's going down, except they asked for identification and they were documenting their records of having verified the accuracy. The reason why this is a county operation where the county feels like that the New York state law doesn't have enough teeth because of the relatively infrequency that you're required to report in person. And the County of Suffolk decided that their police needed to be doing more and more in the way of checks. So they approached what most of us would consider our county commission, but their county legislature, and they asked for an ordinance, for a law that dealt with this. And so the county appropriated money for the Parents for Megan's Law. For this group, and they go out with identification badges. They're supposedly different from law enforcement, but they go out and knock at the door, and they ask to see identification, and they're verifying that matches what's on the registry record with the state.
And I'm assuming that they are not quote unquote like deputized. Do you think they're wearing some kind of official kind of uniform that makes them resemble law enforcement? And to give you an example of what I'm referring to, is one time when they did their little Halloween roundup and we went and sat in the city gymnasium, the cops were just wearing like khakis and sheriff's polo shirts. So they looked, you know, they looked casual. They weren't wearing the whole tactical outfit. So I'm wondering, do you know these people are wearing something that makes them look official like that, that people on the receiving side of this would feel compelled to reply?
Well, it did indicate they're carrying an identification badge, but they said that they're hiring former law enforcement officers. I think that's what the ordinance provided for, that they would hire former law enforcement officers to do this. This Community Protection Act authorized the contract with Parents for Megan's Law to verify the addresses, and it says that they did hire to do these residential verifications. They hired former law enforcement officers. So I suspect that people have considered them to be very official. And one of the guys, the plaintiff's wife, answered the door. She thought they were very official, so she allowed them to wait. And she fetched her husband from his shower to make sure that he could see these verification officers.
What does it give the instructions on what is the punishment for failure to comply with these non-official officials?
I can't find that there is any punishment. I'm open to someone who's in Suffolk County. I can see that the ordinance provides the funding. And I can see that, but I don't see that there's a penalty for failing to comply. I see that they sent, according to the recitation of the facts, I see that the police chief sent a letter encouraging compliance, but it did not,
of course,
it did not mention that bad things will happen to you in the way of prosecution if you do not comply. I think I heard
maybe you were telling me a story about a friend, you know, who was, you know, following the letter of the law, so to speak. And if you didn't respond, you know, they could ask for entry and you like, you don't have any jurisdiction to enter. So F you, don't come in here. And, or you could even like not answer the door. What's the punishment for quote unquote not being home? I'm very curious as to, you would never have to answer these people ever. Make the law enforcement people actually do their jobs.
Well, in fact, I was skimming through it again, and I had failed to highlight it. It says the contract required Parents for Megan's Law to use retired law enforcement officers to conduct the verification visits, whom it calls registry verification field representatives. So the RVRs are retired police officers by the ordinance, but it says that the police did send letters encouraging. It says on July 22nd, 2013, Detective Lieutenant Hernandez sent a letter to all SORA registrants, a letterhead stating that Parents for Megan's Law will be visiting registrants' homes and request to see a photographic identification with current address. It states that registrants are required to provide residential employment verification under SORA. But that doesn't translate that you're required to do it for these private companies. If you've met your state obligation, and is that SORA is the Sex Offender Registration Act of New York that they're referring to, it says that it states that registrants are required to provide residential employment information under SORA. According to Detective Lieutenant Hernandez, after the letter was sent, the issue with noncompliance seemed to have gone away. So apparently that letter was intimidating enough that people opened their door and started complying.
So how about, yeah, I mean, they may be encouraged to, and this makes me think of the Georgia challenge with the signs in the yard. What happens if you just, you know, trash the sign, take it inside, burn it, you know, throw darts at it, whatever. It doesn't, you know, there's no teeth behind it. Fine, you're encouraged to. But I still say FYP, you know, knock on my door all you want. I'm not answering it unless you actually say that you're the sheriff's office from, you know, from your county. And, you know, we're doing our regular check. Otherwise, kick rocks.
Well, I would push back even on that. Unless your state registry statute requires you to respond, and some do say that you will respond, you're required to respond to any inquiry from law enforcement. But those where that's not required, if it says all you have to do is to return this form within 15 days, like it says in Connecticut, I believe it's 10 or 15 days you have to return the form, or if it says you shall report to us in person within 5 days of your birthday or whatever it is, if you've met what the law requires, you don't have to call them. You don't have to answer your door. Your home is one of the most sacred places you have, where you enjoy the utmost right of privacy. And there's nothing requires you to answer the door or to respond to anything unless the law requires you to do it. So people out there who say, well, I have to call them. Well, unless your state says it in the statute, you don't have to call them. They can leave flyers till they're blue in the face. They can knock till they're blue in the face, but you don't have to call them if you're not required to. I don't see anything that actually required these people to do that. They were encouraged to do it, but I don't see that anyway. If they'd answered the door and said, to hell with you people, I don't think anything bad could have happened.
So can we explicitly say what FYP stands for, or have we described clearly enough what FYP stands for through this article?
Well, if I'm not encouraging anyone to do that, because I don't want to be the cause of retaliatory action by law enforcement, and that's exactly what would happen. They might leave your door that day, but they're sitting down with their dart board at the registry office thinking of a way they can catch you on something else and looking for a way to find a technical violation. And these states are so riddled with technicalities of things you have to do and tight time frames on doing them that they will end up finding something else. But I'm just not inclined to do what I'm not required to do. And I ask them the same question. Okay, well, so if you're not required to do something, are you going to do it? I'm not required to do what you. They come to the door and hand me a form, say sign it. I'm not required to sign that damn form. I'm not required to sign that. I'm required to sign a form at the office. I'm not required to sign your form you bring to the door. So, but yeah, I've highlighted several things in here. It says that the registry verification rang the doorbell at the Joneses' home while Jones was showering. Miss Jones answered the door and permitted the men to wait for Jones, assuming they were police officers based on their identification cards and apparel. So I think that they look enough like law enforcement officers that there's an intimidation factor based on what was said here. Wouldn't you?
Alrighty then. So anyway, you can find all that in the show notes too. If you head over to registrymatters.co and you can find the show notes.
Well, assuming that there's no penalty for not doing it, I can't find a constitutional violation. I could hire a group of people to go knock on doors all day long tomorrow and ask people who lives there and say, would you mind showing us ID? There's nothing unconstitutional. There's nothing unconstitutional about knocking at people's doors.
Right. I can't, like, you know, the census people are about to start canvassing the country to count all the peeps. So, I mean, they're going to knock on your door and say,
well, now there actually is a penalty for not complying with the census. There's actually a penalty. It's not a very severe one, but there is a penalty for non-compliance.
Not necessarily that you are required to answer. I know that you're required to answer, but you don't have to answer the person that comes to your door.
No, you don't. But if they don't receive a compliance with the census for that address, they can refer that for handling it. It's a very modest penalty of I think it's like $100 fine or something, but you can be, and they'll gather the information through your neighbors. They'll go do the best they can to put together a profile of what the household looks like.
I only make that comparison to give some sort of teeth to somebody with in a civilian capacity but under a government direction to come knock on your door and see who's there. These people they're not performing a constitutional function. They're performing a function that the city has contracted them to do, and they have no law enforcement, they're not deputized or anything of that nature that you are required to answer them. It doesn't seem.
So, well, like I said, without me seeing the penalty for failing to answer, I'm not thinking that there's anything bad could happen to you officially, but I think some bad things unofficially could happen to you. And that's what I always encourage people to be aware of, the unofficial things that happen to you. The interesting thing is for people, they found the special needs doctrine applied. So even if this did constitute, they ducked the issue, but they said for sake of making a decision, even if this did amount to a detention and search and seizure or whatever, the special needs doctrine covered it, which is what I tell people when they say, well, Larry, why doesn't NARSTA try to do something to stop the home invasions? And this is a perfect example, because I've said that they're going to always, there's the community caretaker doctrine, and they're going to say, well, we don't really have a particular statute that says we have to do this, but and our special role for protecting the community, we go out and do these safety checks. We go check on elderly people all the time. We receive safety people concerned about the safety and welfare of a loved one, and we'll go out, knock at the door, and we'll look in the curtains, and we'll even ask to come in to see if they look like that they're deprived of anything, that they're in any type of danger, and we do that all the time, and it's a part of our caretaker role. And same thing for the sex offenders. We're not trying to harass them or make their life miserable. We're just going out to make sure that the community is being taken care of, and it's not intended to do anything other than just make contact and let them know that we're there. And and that's their defense. Do I agree with it? No, I don't. But the courts are going to. And this is an example of a court that did agree with it. So that's why we're not convinced that this is such a stellar challenge.
What is the community caretaker doctrine?
That's where if an elderly person, they'll go knock at their door. If they may not have any law enforcement business whatsoever with the person, but they'll knock at the door and say, "Mr. Jones, we came by to check on you. Do you mind if we come in?" And they go look around and they see that he hasn't caring for himself. The trash hasn't been taken out in 3 weeks, and there's raw food and there's signs of rodent infestation. Well, that's the role of a community caretaker. They didn't have any probable cause. They just know that he's older. They know so they go in, look around, and he invites them in, and they report him to social to Adult Protective Services, and they try to get him help. Well, they use the same argument about the sex offender registry. They say, well, we're not doing these compliance checks to harass the sex offenders at all. I mean, we make sure that they've taken their medication, because not taking their medication or not being in counseling can cause them to reoffend. And we don't want that for the safety of our community. So we're just touching base with them to see how they're doing and remind them that they have an update due and whatnot. I mean, there's nothing, it's all about violating their constitutional rights. We're there to help and protect the community.
Interesting.
So going to court on this is going to be a tough road to hoe. And that's what I'm comparing this decision to. Now, this was not law enforcement doing it. Law enforcement is even going to get more deference because they're highly trained, supposedly, and they know the limits of what they can and cannot do. And of course, law enforcement would never stray beyond what they're allowed to do. So just because these things were not specifically required by your state statute, that doesn't magically make them unconstitutional. What might make them magically unconstitutional would be if you documented how frequently they do it, the specifics. If they go to your neighbors and say bad things about you, if you can get your neighbors to talk to you about what was said, if they leave open face flyers that say sex offender unit, if they bang really loud, if they have sex offender insignia all over their apparel, if they stand out there with a bullhorn and say, "Come outside, we have to see you now." There's so many variables, and you have to document all this stuff where it might rise to a level of a constitutional violation. But merely knocking at your door and saying, "We'd like to touch base with you," that doesn't magically become unconstitutional because you don't like something. That's the reason why I want to get this civil regulatory scheme out of law enforcement's hands. Then they won't be knocking at your door. Of course, then we'll have to worry about private nonprofits like Parents for Megan's Law that would be knocking at the door.
I don't think we're going to win, Larry. We're never going to need to stop doing this podcast.
That is correct. this is those who think that the magic end of the registry is coming. I'm sorry to disappoint, but there's no silver bullet. We'll be fighting constitutional infractions. There will always be creative juices flowing to figure out new things to do, new laws to propose, new ways to violate. If that was the case, the ACLU would long since be out of business. There will never be the end of lawmaking. And as long as you have an unfavored population that you stigmatize with a list, there are always going to be people proposing to do bad things to the people on that list. That's why we have to get rid of the list, or at least the public part of the list.
Right.
Because
that's how I feel.
The public shaming is what makes it. I mean, I wouldn't want any list, period. But the public shaming, the guy that got beat up in the park, without the public list, they wouldn't have likely known about it.
Correct. I totally agree with that.
Or thought they knew about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, before we hit the last thing, we'll hit this one real quick. Is this Utah man? This is from the Salt Lake Tribune. Utah man deemed innocent and state will pay him $350,000 after his sons lied about being sexually abused. We talk about this one all the time, and we covered something earlier about innocent people being released. This one seems to. Did you find there were any further details besides that the sons all recanted that their testimony was there? Did you find that there was more evidence besides just that little bit?
I did not find. I found that the attorney general reinvestigated it based on the motion for that was made based on newly discovered evidence of the recantation, and they came to a conclusion that the man was factually innocent, and they did not stand in the way of setting aside the conviction. That is rare, and I would welcome someone from Utah that might be aware of more details, but it's exceedingly rare. It's great for him. After all those years, about 13 years that this ordeal was a part of his life, but he's getting a little compensation, and getting the conviction and the vestiges of the he actually pled guilty. He went to trial the first time, and then he pled guilty because he didn't want to go through a trial again, and he took a deal. So
we have a double whammy here. So the guy took it to trial, but then he actually why would an innocent person ever claim to cop out to a plea deal? So he did that too, and then wow, that's a trifecta.
It is. It's an amazing story, and the state rolled over, and that's very rare. So the alleged victims were apparently very compelling, and the evidence no longer supported their conviction.
You told me earlier that you thought that there would be some sort of underlying evidence to then, like, you know, opening a new case almost. I think that's sort of how you worded it.
That is
right?
Generally what's a recantation alone is not generally enough.
Because now you have a person lying one side of twice, right?
You have a person who's a proven liar. And what you don't know is the motive for either time they lied. You know that they're lying one of the times because both stories cannot be true. So you're de facto a liar when you recant, because the story that you're telling, that the recantation may be true, but the story that you told previously, if that's not true, you are a liar. And at that point, you're an uncredible witness. So normally you need additional evidence. Now, the additional evidence may have been unearthed in this investigation that was generated by the attorney's motion, the actual innocence provision they have in Utah law. And he's not the only one. They said they released some others that had been in prison. Deborah Brown served 17 years for shooting that she didn't do, and she only got $500,000. And then Joel Griesman, prison for 3 years for aggravated sexual assault before being cleared by DNA, he got $220,000. And it goes on and on with people who've been awarded some money for this. But apparently there's a provision in Utah law for this very thing to happen, and the investigation probably did unearth some additional evidence, but it wasn't clear what it was.
That's just fascinating that this could happen. And, you know, we had, I don't remember the details, but the thing last week where the judge didn't have a vehicle to release the guy that had been locked up for 733 years or some craziness like that.
Yeah. But Utah has a vehicle. That's the difference.
Okay.
Yeah. Utah has a vehicle, you know, for this actual innocence claim to be made.
Would otherwise these be functionally similar? Just one has the vehicle, the other one does not. That's crazy, right, Larry? That's so crazy. It's a further example of us having 50 individual quote unquote countries with their own laws and rules, regulations, and all that.
Then fix it with your Missouri legislature. If you think there should be a process, convince your fellow citizens, as Justice Scalia says, of the need for that, and fix it.
That's crazy. God, is that crazy, Larry?
You don't want the court to legislate from the bench, do you?
No, but I'm thinking of there being something of parity between them that, okay, well, you know, we'll call it tomato in this state, we'll call it tomato in that state, but it's functionally the same thing between them to do the same thing. That's what I'm referring to.
Well, there's some enlightenment in Utah. Apparently they provided a process.
All right. Then our final, before we go to our listener question. We have the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. You know, this is another one of those things where I have no idea what this is, and you're springing it on me last second. I see lots of yellow highlights, and I'm just going to say, take it away.
Well, this is an example of something can be illegal and legal at the same time. This was a 37-year-old who engaged in a sexual relationship with BA, who was a 16-year-old girl, and on multiple occasions the two met in Omaha to have sexual intercourse. And during the relationship, Rouse suggested that they record their sexual activity, and BA agreed, and he used a cell phone to film. Well, the only problem is that even though you can give consent to have sex at age 16, you cannot consent to be photographed and have that disseminated. So so he broke the federal law by disseminating it through an instrument of interstate commerce. He's not allowed to do the visual, to create the visual depiction. So he argued unsuccessfully. Now, this is the Eighth Circuit, which constitutes the central part of the United States, Arkansas, Oklahoma, not Oklahoma, excuse me, Nebraska, a number of states, Minnesota. And he made this argument that he had the right to, since it was an intimate relationship that was legal, that he had the right to record it. But the creation of child porn is not protected by the First Amendment. And so since the U.S. Congress has decided that you cannot create images, pictures and images and of people that are deemed minors and for federal purposes is under 18. So you can have all the sex you want, but you cannot make pictures of it and send it across state lines. So he's serving 96 months in federal prison for the pictures, but the sex was just fine.
Right. It's so bizarre. This is something from a bygone era. This is something where one side of the equation seems more appropriate than the other. That's just so weird to me. You can do the deed, but you can't have a memorial of it.
But there is a rational basis for it to some degree. The deed itself is a private thing. When you transmit this out there and create a visual depiction and it starts going across the internet, that's no longer private. And society has collectively decided that visual depictions of minors being transmitted through instruments of interstate commerce is not in the national interest. So he broke federal law by doing that.
All righty then. So you agree with this decision, though?
I'm saying that it is supported by the underlying body of case law that's developed regarding... Society has decided through its collective lawmaking that they do not want magazines, video cassettes, any type of depictions of minors' genitalia distributed across state lines. That's a decision we made as a nation.
Gotcha.
You as an individual don't have the right to override the collective wisdom of the people. They have decided that you're not allowed to make these pictures and transmit them across state lines. Now, he could have kept them in his home privately and no one would have ever known about it.
Certainly that.
But when he transmitted them to BK or ZK or whatever her initials are, when he transmitted them to her and her parents found out about them, that changed the equation because they had been transmitted in interstate commerce. And it said it may not be illegal for an adult to place an unclothed child on a bed, but when the adult produces and distributes images of the child contained lascivious exposition of the child's genitals, the activity is illegal and outside the protection of the First Amendment. That's just the way it is. It's not protected by the First Amendment. Your First Amendment claim doesn't apply there because society has decided that it wants to protect minors from being depicted. Right. Now, we can change it anytime we want to. All we have to do is tell Congress that we don't like that law. And if enough of us tell Congress that, we can change that. But it is the law. So he's serving 8 times 12, 96. He's got an 8-year sentence for having consensual sex. Isn't that a great outcome?
That's amazing. That sounds amazing.
And so now this is binding precedent in the Eighth Circuit. All the states there in the Eighth Circuit that where someone tries to assert this as a defense, they have been foreclosed because they'll be laughed out of court when you're a defense attorney when you say, well, I ought not have to be plead guilty to this thing. The feds, I mean, it was legal for me to have sex. Arkansas law, you only got to be 16. And your federal public pretender, as you call it, they're going to say, well, it doesn't matter what Arkansas law says. The federal law says that you can't transmit those images in interstate using instrumentalities of interstate commerce. And you did that. So therefore, you have committed a federal crime. Well, but it just ain't right. But that's the way it is. So,
real quickly, Larry, touch on the precedent that it sets. So does the Seventh Circuit have to follow what the Eighth Circuit said?
No.
But
they're going to. They're going to, because okay. It's quoting U.S. Supreme Court decisions. It's quoting a number of U.S. Supreme Court decisions going back for decades. It's quoting Ferber and some other United States Supreme Court decisions. So they are going to, although they're not bound to.
And I was speaking more generically as far as we get the question a lot. Well, you know, the Eighth Circuit said, Ninth Circuit said, whatever. Well, then the First Circuit does or doesn't have to. It's precedent. It's encouraged. It's strongly weightful, but doesn't mean they have to. But
it's persuasive authority. But since they cited U.S. Supreme Court decisions to come to their decision, the other circuits are going to look at those same. They're going to look at Ferber. They're going to look at Ashcroft versus Free Speech Coalition, and they're going to look at Osborne versus Ohio. These U.S. Supreme Court decisions that were cited here, New York versus Ferber, goes back to 1982, and the U.S. Supreme Court held that child pornography is without the protection of the First Amendment. So we already know the U.S. Supreme Court has said that child pornography does not enjoy First Amendment protection. So you can wish it did all you want to, and you can say it ought to all you want to, but the highest interpreter of the Constitution has said it does not. So that's not the way it ought to be, in your opinion, but that's the way it is being.
Okay. Well, can we move on to this listener question then?
I would be delighted. What does the listener want to know? Because I probably don't know.
It's more of a hypothetical, just some advice. And I put together a couple things. I got it over a couple of different exchanges, but it says, hey, I was hoping you could help me. This is from Jonathan, or get Larry to help me quickly. I'm going to sit down with the school soon to deal with my ability to pick up / drop off our son, attend conferences and sporting events. I know I'm on firm ground regarding Maine law, but I wanted some extra ammo in case they decide they want to implement town ordinances to prevent me. I want to head them off and caution them to narrowly tailor it and make it an individual determination. So I was wondering if you let me skip ahead then. So then the follow-up a couple days later says, well, it looks like I'm going to have to ramp up another legal fund. Damn it. Already broke from this case. I had the meeting with the school this morning. They are claiming that passing a student in the hall would be indirect contact if it's not because the law they are taking that applies everywhere else in Maine. I literally wouldn't be allowed to leave my house in order to obey it. Also stated, even if it wasn't, they are issuing a trespass warning to me. No cause, no event of complaint, just because they want to prevent me from being on school property. Basically, admitted to us that it's because parents who know I'm a registrant might call the superintendent and basically told me, go to court if you want. We won't allow you on property, period. It's a public relations issue, and that they want money for the lawyers. I'm pissed. I'm trying to work with them and come up with a plan that makes everyone comfortable. And basically, it was F you, sue us. Any advice?
Well, what's interesting is that this is what's typical, is we don't never have enough information on these questions. What we don't know from this is we don't know that if this was an imaginary problem where a person like the Mitch McGuire case, where the guy had no registration obligation in Colorado, and he went down to the registry office in Alabama because he thought that he might have a registration obligation. And he said, do I have to register? And they said, well, yeah, hang on the lobby for a while. We'll do a little bit of checking. And it'd be like the guy in North Carolina who went second and third and fourth time and said, what we don't know in this question is, had he been instructed that he could not be on school grounds, and if by so, what they cited as the authority for that, or did he go in and say, I'm on the sex offender registry. Can I be on the school grounds? So I'm not clear what generated the discussion about it, because he says, well, hopefully they'll narrowly tailor an ordinance. Okay, well, since they don't have an ordinance yet, we can rule that out. But he says, well, they said they issued no trespass order. Did they issue the no trespass order after he went and revealed I'm a registrant and I'd like to participate in my kids? Or did they approach him? What order did this unfold in? That would be very helpful to know.
Okay, and can you then posit in both directions?
Well, if he was informed by the school system that he could not be on school grounds. And he did not go in and make that voluntary disclosure. If they just have this thing about checking all their students against the sex offender registry and looking at the names of course, depending on the state, you may not find everybody. But if they just unilaterally notified him that you're a sex offender, you can't build school grounds, that would be a little bit problematic, because at the very minimum, you would need a policy. So you'd be right in asking them for the policy. Well, okay, you've sent me a notice saying I can't build school grounds. What's the underlying policy for that? Well, if there is no policy, then it's kind of arbitrary and capricious. You at least would want to get their policy that supports that. And I have heard of that before. So it's not bizarre that I knew a person here where his wife was a assistant principal and they gave him official notice that he would be trespassing if he ever dared come in. He's got three kids in the school system here. And they said, if you come in anywhere near any Albuquerque public school, you will be trespassing. And so they gave him a no trespass notice. He elected not to fight it because the employment relationship exists. And because I opined that I thought that since there is no law here, and there is no policy that they could cite to, that they just simply gave him a no trespass notice. How did they determine that he would, what was the criteria? You can be on the registry for some relatively benign things. So how did they determine that he should be banned? So I think that he might have something he can do, but it would be very nice if we knew the specifics of how this directive to him came about before he sues.
I did try and get him on, and he is about to have a new addition to his family, and he wasn't sure what his schedule is going to be like. Maybe he's about to have a kid now, so he couldn't commit to coming on tonight.
Well, we can pick this up again on a future episode, but I am a big advocate for fighting that tooth and nail, because I think that's one of the most sacred rights you have, would be to associate with your child as they're growing up. And if you take that away from a person, that's a significant intrusion. So that is something I'd like to see challenged.
And Ashley, you know, your attorney there in New Mexico, she says with a high degree of certainty that you have a constitutional right to be a parent to your children.
Well, and since we have compulsory attendance. Schools are not elective. You know, most schools, most states have to at least age 16, and some even, I think, even beyond 16, maybe 17 or 18. But since we have compulsory attendance, and I'm for that, so this is not knocking compulsory school attendance, but since we have compulsory attendance, the state is taking possession of your children for a certain number of hours each day. And for the state to take possession of your children and say that we're going to exclude you from participation because of something you've done in the past, to me, is very problematic, because then they should exclude everybody's kid. I mean, you're not on equal. As you're growing up, parental involvement and how much support you have from your parents impacts the success and the outcomes. We know that. We know that unequivocally. We know that.
Can I take us on a detour that's going to get me a bunch of hate mail?
Well, as long as you don't mind the hate mail.
There's a faction of this country that is all about some family involvement, you know, parenting and all that stuff, that we would then say, oh, wait, these people don't deserve that same right, at the expense of some boogeyman level of threat that you're going to pass my kid and give them cooties as you pass them in the hallway.
I think I can see a correlation there. But we face those inconsistencies all the time. People who claim to be big family values people, when you dig below the surface, you find out that they're not as much about family values as they profess to be.
That's you said it more eloquent than me. That's for sure.
But yes, I would like to see more challenges in terms of access to publicly funded. This falls in the realm. Public education is publicly funded. I'd like to see more challenges in terms of access to parks that are publicly funded. I just don't see how these prohibitions would survive a well-funded, well-organized challenge. And I mean, well-funded. That these things cost, you can't do everything right on summary judgment. Some of the facts that you, when you look through my highlights, on the case, there was recidivism became a fact that was established below because they decided the case on summary judgment on where there should have been a trial. With summary judgment, you don't build an evidentiary record, and that was in the Second Circuit decision that was problematic.
Got it.
Because it was decided on summary judgment, so recidivism did come into there because it was a fact established below.
Are you ready to shut it down? I think we're ready to shut it down.
Yeah, I forgot to make that comment. The police commissioner and the parents for Megan's Law, they both cited erroneous statistics. That when they testified in support of the bill for the Suffolk County Commission, Suffolk County Legislature, they testified that it's a known fact that recidivism goes down when the sex offender registry is accurate, and they made some erroneous statements, but those were a part of the evidentiary record in this case because it was decided on summary judgment, and the court was stuck with that because on summary judgment those were assumed to be true facts.
Interesting. Well, there you have it. Larry has spoken, and that's the final word, and that's all we need to know.
Well, how do we get 6 more podcast supporters this week?
6 would be incredible. Let's come up with some sort of idea. What will we do? If we get 6 more Patreon people, that means you have from Tuesday when this gets out to the non-patron people till Saturday to get new people signed up. What should we do, Larry? How about you play a saxophone on the podcast if we get 6 more Patreon people?
Well, if you want me to play a saxophone, that's going to be really, really bizarre.
I have one in my closet, so I could possibly be persuaded to do that if 6 people sign up on Patreon. How about that?
I played a trombone when I was in the 6th grade for 1 year in band. And,
did you really? I didn't know that.
I had a girl that outplayed me every time when we did our competition for chairs, and I couldn't understand why that I couldn't be first chair, but I always ended up being second chair.
Jeepers, man. That's tragic.
I think there was 4 trombonists in the band.
Oh, man. Well, you were at least in the top 50.
Yeah, I was at least in the top 50. Sure.
All right. Well, head over to registrymatters.co to listen to the podcast. Look for the show notes. There's a transcription there that gets done. It's done by a computer, so you know it might not be entirely so accurate. Larry, what's the phone number? Because I know you always have that.
Well, that I do have. It's 747-227-4477. And we are permanently signing off next week. If there are no phone calls, we're going to pull this number and that'll be the end of it.
Oh, you know what? Somebody did phone in and left a voicemail message and I need to send it to you. And they said, don't put this on the air. So we did get a call. I totally forgot to share it with you.
So was it a coherent one?
It was more or less, yeah. And the person sounded, they had a decent voice. It wasn't, they weren't stammering and stuttering like some of the people that dial in. And then over there, you can leave some, if you want to send us an email message, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And Larry, let's see. It's almost, people are going to start filing some tax returns soon. So maybe someone could donate their whole return.
Sure, that'll happen.
And you would do that over at patreon.com/registrymatters.
And it does indeed have a search function. So if you get to Patreon, that's all you have to do. You can find Registry Matters.
Beautiful, beautiful. Larry, I have to like skip town and go get some ice cream because they're about to close. So we got to shut this
all
down.
All right. So, well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, everybody in chat. And we will talk to you soon. Have a great night.
Good night.